prayer or something. Again, I'm gonna put in the story. Maybe. Just analyzing a little bit. How it all developed and what happened after Prabhupada came and started all of this, and his students came here to Sweden starting everything called the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Now, when I joined it, which was like 5 years after it all started here in Sweden, we were seekers, enthusiasts, some of us kind of intellectuals, university kids. I wasn't, I was more of a artist, philosophical speculator or whatever. Having started to become attracted to and interested in old mysticism, which it is called, which to me intriguingly enough seemed so similar between different cultures on this planet. And when it's so similar, something between countries, which, you know, probably didn't have much connection with each other. And also when we're talking about the occult, as some would say, I mean, knowledge that is kind of, even in the society where it's living, is kind of hidden. So anyway, some of us were like that, and some very philosophically astute. But then some things happened, and I would say that part of what happened was that some saw this as, you know, this is a movement, this is an organization. Well, others call it a cult. But it is something that we should recruit members into. So, well, I became one of those preachers, as we were called, who, you know, for me, before I came into contact with this Krishna consciousness movement, I was kind of, had already decided I wanted to spend my life, you know, learning the good things, wisdom and knowledge that can help us all here, and then, you know, assist in spreading that and doing some good for the people in this world and for myself, first of all, of course. First, show your own example. So, and to us, most of us, I would say, the early ones, that's what quote-unquote preaching was about. And I never liked the word because it sounded very, you know, Christian priest on the altar preaching to us, which I hated. So then what happened then was that, and it came from the big country over in the West, I think, and other places, techniques were introduced and we were taught them how to make a person just doubt their whole existence, everything they believed in so far and all of it. Well, much like I did when I got my awakening when I was 20, after reading that book about macrobiotics and Zen, you know, Japanese. So yeah. But then the thing is that those little tricks and techniques, like I was, and here we can put in the story, you know, you've got Bhakta Piyo, who is very new, but who has this determination that, yes, I want to, you know, present this to others. Sitting there on the Sunday feast, talking to a couple of girls. And I said this, told this story before, but, and then one of the very senior, one of the 11, you know, Sonal Acharyas, Swami, big, and he's still big. And this is being spoken. He sat down next to me and listened in and then told me that, or asked me, what are you talking about? What are you doing? So I was just trying to understand how they think. And he said, you don't care about how they think. You tell them where things are at. And then he took over and started like cutting them down a bit viciously, the way I saw it, and I would see it even more so today, I think. And then just started telling them the absolute truth. So, yeah, I mean, I saw some joining the movement in that way, you know, after getting all their defenses scattered. And you know, and then accept, yeah, the only thing I can do now is accept this and what they tell me, so I join. I guess there's nothing left for me to live out there. But some of us, I think many of us did back then. And some, you know, as a Bhagavad-gita tell you, how there are different reasons why you may take up this bhakti or this yoga path. One is you're in search for the absolute truth, or you're just inquisitive in general. And then there, you know, one is simply someone who's troubled and need money and all that. It's money and all that. So, but we were mainly, I would say, seekers. But then another crew started to gather there in the temples, people who were lonely, who were, some of them were a bit crazy, had mental problems, this and that, and they were outsiders and couldn't find a place with people who liked them. So, yeah, we go to the Krishna temple and free food and all that, great food. And look, they are friends with us. They treat us like friends. And so I join, yes, and then you do, and then you have to, you work, serve in the restaurant or whatever, clean the floors, go to the programs. We have to do that also. But we get the food, we get a place to stay, and we get, you know, friends, a social. It's here. Yeah. So, and then I interviewed a few of those, and I've been speaking about this before. Why did you join this? Why did you, you know, become a brahmachari or whatever? And some said it straight, it's because of the food, things like that. But then, well, you know, that worked because they could do the down on the floor labor, so to speak. But then something else happened. And I would say this kind of conjoins or corresponds to what I now understood is happening in the Swedish society. Because there were conflicts, there were problems, and it has now become a bit authoritarian, hierarchic. You follow the leader, and I am the leader. Otherwise, you know, go somewhere else. And many, actually I would say many, quite a few, had started going somewhere else. Or they didn't want anymore to do the menial services. Because the only way then to, you know, distinguish yourself as a personality of some value was to either, you know, start your own project or become the boss of it, or, you know, rise in the ranks. And as we said, too many chiefs and too few Indians. Well, we use that expression quite fairly often, actually, to illustrate what we saw happening. So, what happened then was that you got people, you know, members from the International Society of Krishna Consciousness in other countries, especially East Europe, which, of course, you know, in the early 90s opened up. And Sweden was kind of flooded with people from, you know, former Soviet Union and places belonging to that. And I saw it myself when I was temple president in Gothenburg between 93 and 97. And when I tried to run this whole Krishna temple there and the restaurant as a joint effort among all of us who were interested in being the voice of Krishna in Gothenburg. But then something happened which even made me give up my position, leave that to someone else. You know who you are. Who then supported the modern way, as some saw it. It wasn't really, you know. Anyway, which was about renting brahmacharis and brahmacharinis, new members of ISKCON in well, in our case it was Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia as it was called then. You come and you join the temple in Prague. Surrender your life to Krishna, give up your education, your job, anything, everything, the family ties and all of that. And as a reward for that surrender, you are sent to Sweden to work day and night, basically, in a kitchen, in a restaurant, cutting vegetables, cleaning, fixing, washing the pots, all of that, every day, long days. And when you can't do it anymore, when you're burnt out, generally after 2 or 3 months, you're sent back and a new crew comes in, and the temple presidents, as they were called and are called, I guess still, they paid each other for that. So yeah, I need some restaurant workers, I pay you so and so much per month, per person. And I think they were very cheap. And in this way we run things. Now, in the society here, we saw that happening even more. I mean, the Swedish society in general. And I heard this is a common issue in the modern Western societies. People, they don't want to do all that dirty job anymore. So they invite immigrants, refugees and whatever, they come. And you can do all that work, which we don't want to do, cheap. You know, some are satisfied just by being allowed to stay and having a room to live in and getting some food, some pocket money. So yeah, good, great idea, right? And I saw it in America, you know, Mexicans working everywhere there in California. I guess very cheap just for you, and you can build your companies on that. I washed my car there in San Francisco, I think it was. You know, you just pay a few dollars and your whole car is washed outside and inside by a team of Mexican workers. And what they got per month, I have no idea. But, you know, that's how things developed. So why am I saying all this? Because the social implications of this, and I'm talking about this organization called ISKCON, where I saw this myself at close range. Direct observer. What happens is that what happened, and it's happening even more nowadays, and that's why I think it's important enough to be mentioned here. The temples that were mostly built by, well, Swedish devotees. The house I live in was basically built, I mean, renovated from almost a complete wreck to a fine building back in 1992 or 1993 or something. And yeah, some of those who worked there were from East Europe, some were from Germany. And they were, again, rented by the temple president from some other temple. And some came from the Czech Republic and so on. So anyway, but even back then, it was much like that. But the older temples were purchased, renovated, built up by local, you know, devotees, members of the ISKCON here in Sweden, who had joined here. Now, what it how it looks now is that most of those who did that, they moved away from there. Mainly, I would say, if you ask them, because they felt that things were not being run properly. And then here we can see, especially, we have Indians, Russians, and again people from the former Soviet Union and others, some also from Middle East, dominating, you know, the attendance and the activities here in the house where I live. Now, what happens then is, well, we were, most of us who built up things here, not experienced, neither with management nor construction nor nothing. So we had to learn. And we often did things in awkward ways that others in the Swedish society, which is pretty, very neat and well organized in that sense, things should be done this way, that way, and look okay. Otherwise, they will become suspicious or criticize you, whatever. So we had struggled with that, to learn ourselves. Hello. How to do it properly. I don't know if anything can be heard here, but let's give it a try. But you know, when you got a temple or whatever probably dominated by people who also live there, who come from other completely different cultures, and even there maybe not so, how to say, experienced with, you know, how to live like ordinary normal people. And there was even, and is even, that idea that you shouldn't do that, that's just what the karma is, you know, you should do it the real way, the ISKCON way. And something, you know, develops that can look very strange. Just a way to repair a building, for instance. I had a house down south of Sweden, and I sometimes brought in people from Eastern Europe to do renovation work. And when I sold it, the, you know, the people inspecting it, building engineers, they just shook their heads, said, you don't do it this way. And you know how to behave, how to dress. So in this way, the group, you know, gets marginalized, and rightly so, because it starts to act strangely and also in many ways dysfunctionally. But you easily, you know, you get used to it when you are in a social group, especially if it's kind of isolated in, yeah, what we call a bubble, where whatever is outside of the walls of that bubble is bad and useless and materialistic and karmi-ish and so on. Then you, I mean, I would say surprisingly quickly can adjust to, well, just about any social standards or situation. Because this group psychology is very powerful. If everyone in your group does it, and you don't have anyone out around there in the big world to compare to or as an ideal to follow. The ideal is the monks in saffron robes who basically never, some of them, stepped into any, you know, proper jobs or management experiences, or, you know, they were outsiders maybe their whole life, and living in a room, being served food and someone dressing, you know, washing their clothes and cleaning their floors and taking care of everything. And they then became the ultimate, they got the final word. They were raised, adored, worshipped as the greatest supreme authorities for everything, including how, well, you and I should live our lives, and even marriages, partners, how to live successfully, how to run your company, how to run your temple, how to take care of people and children and so on. And that, of course, is not the greatest formula and recipe for success. So I'm saying all this because what I'm seeing now, I'm 71, and more than, you know, 50 years have passed since I came into this movement, almost 50 years. And I see it now from a little bit of a distance, because I'm a private person now, as most of us are, civilian. And we sometimes, yes, shake our heads a little bit. And as someone said, who's also from that generation of mine, a little younger, but it's like a badly managed company. And you know, badly managed company or country or whatever, we see that it causes problems for the people in it. And that's why I am speaking these words. I'm not just here to criticize. I'm concerned about the people. And, you know, we have stories. Some of them are pure horror stories about how children were treated, how women were treated, and how the, you know, the simple devotees down on the floor, so to speak, were treated and are still being treated, I think. And yes, you know, the way to deal with that, of course, then becomes often the way, not the smartest way, but just a way, is to just ignore that. Say, no, everything is fine. Or you're also one of those criticizers. Oof, you're a demon. So in this way, you shove those voices, those people, outside of the bubble, and they can't reach in there anymore, and they don't even care. Because why should they? And things go on, and the bubble will shrink more and more. But then you get the, again, you might think it's growing because you get all the, you know, immigrants or people coming from other countries, what I can see now is that Indians, the Hindu community here in Sweden, started to look at these properties, these temples. You know, they are worth quite a lot if they are in good shape. And yeah, we can use them. Things like that. Or you've got people from, you know, Russia. There may be all kinds of different motivations lurking beneath the surface. And I'm not talking anything wrong with immigrants. I'm just saying that there are people coming in other than those who built it up and with maybe other motivations and interests involved. And you know, when there are properties like the building we have here that I live in, we bought it for like 3 million Swedish crowns, and now it is valued to, if it was in good shape, 30 million, something like that. So, you know, for the simple spiritual people who learn not to care about money and such mundane things, they don't even know how much it's worth. They don't care. For them, it's the temple and the home. But there are others who look mainly at money, or they look mainly at, you know, power. Here we can easily get a powerful position in charge of, you know, a property and a project worth pretty much, and people who would work for me, do what I say. I mean, there are temptations there. Therefore, some of us have been pushing this now, and I'm told to push things, but I'm just saying, and some old God brothers of mine who know how things work in this world, that yeah, we should put these properties in foundations, secure them. So anyway, this is a story, and it's basically just my little analysis of the history and the situation back then and now, for whatever it's worth. If you agree with me, then you do. Otherwise, you tell your story, give your version. But what I'm really saying here is that let's not fool ourselves. Let's not, you know, develop illusions. Born of this cognitive dissonance that we are not ready to, or willing, or daring to accept and see the actual real situation. Because then, you know, I would say that kind of cognitive dissonance, that kind of denial of, or I would say just ignorance, especially up in the those who are responsible now, or these ideas coming in that now I'm in charge and I do what I want with this, great, without even being aware of and acknowledging the fact that what you are quote-unquote in charge of is a service to maintain and continue and, you know, further develop something that has been built, upheld by many people through many years. We are talking here more than 50 years. And my final advice is, if you find yourself in such a position as a manager or whatever, in charge of something that is one of those projects or properties, you have to see yourself as that servant. You have to see that reality. if you don't, you can destroy things and you will get bad, you know, karma. But, you know, Krishna will be displeased with you and teach you a lesson. And if you treat Krishna's devotees, you know, and some may be in such humble positions that you don't even notice them. You think they're not really good devotees. But that judgment attitude is very dangerous. Because if someone chants Hare Krishna and has given up, you know, their life's best years for serving, you know, Prabhupada's movement and Chaitanya Nityananda's movement the best they can, even if they have shown and are still showing fallacies, then you should not. And I've heard those still, all these from our generation who speak like that about the simple devotees down there. Oh, he's like that, you know, and we heard this and that, you know, the gossip thing. He has that problem and he's not behaving properly or up to the standard. And well, I mean, I can tell stories about the big leaders and they're coming out more and more. If you want to talk about improper behavior and, you know, weaknesses and faults. So, again, I'm really nagging about this because this is, I would say, the secret formula for how to get this Prabhupada's ISKCON movement off the ground finally and get it to flourish. We saw it started to flourish, and some may, you know, imagine and convince themselves that it's continuously flourishing more and more since then. But if you open your eyes, well, you might see it a bit the way I'm describing here. And again, I'm saying that the secret is, the most important thing to start with is, you want to be, take up some leadership position over any of these projects. I'm talking about Sweden or the Krishna Consciousness Movement here. See that as an opportunity and a responsibility that you're taking on yourself to serve the devotees, serve the Vaishnavas, and that's the mood that it's about. This is what we learned when we were new. We should serve the Prabhu, serve the devotees. Krishna becomes very pleased then. And the simple devotees, we should serve them. We learned this when we were out there on Sankirtan selling the books. And we were so dependent on him. We saw things, you know, from the street, so to speak, and learn to really appreciate anyone, you know, who came in there surrendering to Krishna, moving in and serving Krishna every day. Not really, and I would say we even came to not make much distinction between the big ones up there and the small ones down on the floor, because we're all equals, eternal servants of Krishna, of Prabhupada in our case.